Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, talking all things movement, whole food nutrition and environmental wellness with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 14, season 2. My name is Ben Adelberg and joined by my co-host, Emma Strutt. Hello, Emma.
G'day, g'day. How you going, Ben?
Very good, thank you. Just a quick note to our faithful listeners, a little apology for last week's audio quality. We just want to remind everyone that we're not going to blame this solely on Emma, but, you know, because we do these all remotely, we are reliant on, you know, quality of reception. And last week during that recording, there was actually a bit of a storm happening down south of New Zealand when we interviewed Dr. Martin Williamson. So apologies for that. Today is all perfect, crystal clear. Emma, who are we talking to today?
So far, so good. Hopefully it stays that way. Okay, so today we are joined by the lovely Fuchsia Goldsmith, a dietitian based in Auckland. Fuchsia is the founder of Feed Nutrition. She is an advisory council member for the health promotion charity Doctors for Nutrition, serving as their lead dietitian for New Zealand's North Island. And she also works at North Shore Hospital as a clinical dietitian in the area of chronic kidney disease. Fuchsia has also published a number of really fascinating research papers and presented on them internationally. So I'm very much looking forward to having this conversation today. Fuchsia, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to have another dietitian finally on the show.
Oh, thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Now, I feel a little bit outnumbered, 2 to 1 women to men and 2 dietitians. So this is surely going to be a fascinating conversation. So I'll start with an easy one, Fuchsia. Firstly, thank you again for coming onto the show. Let's start off a little bit about yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background, your lifestyle, and ultimately your own personal journey, because I believe you have a personal story as to what got you toward a whole food plant-based lifestyle.
Yeah. So I guess I grew up up in Whangarei, which is about 3 hours north of Auckland here. And growing up sort of on a 50-acre block of forest, I had a really keen sense of the link between our food system and what we're putting on our plate and what goes into our bodies. So I've always sort of had quite a keen interest in nutrition, and I actually grew up sort of following more or less a pescatarian diet. We tried to grow as much of our own fruits and vegetables as we could on our property, and any sort of fish that snuck into the diet was sort of stuff that had been caught at our local beaches and seafood that we'd sort of collected locally. So, yeah, so that's sort of how I grew up. And then when I was about 11 years old, I sort of started to question this. I sort of had this sense of kind of dissonance. I didn't really understand why it wasn't okay to eat sort of chicken and beef, but it was okay to eat fish. And so, yeah, at the age of 11, I sort of decided that it didn't really make a lot of sense, and actually decided to go vegetarian. And at that time, and with the understanding I had then, I felt that that was the best thing for my own health and for the animals as well. So I kept going with that for a number of years until I kind of had that same sort of sense of dissonance, actually, when I was eating sort of eggs and dairy products. So I was about, pardon me, I was about 15 and sort of living in London, and sort of started doing a research project into the treatment of animals in the dairy and egg industry, I guess. And I was sort of quite shocked by what I saw, and seeing sort of what was happening in those farms sort of made me feel that there was no way that was good for our health. And so that's sort of what drove me to change my diet. And I actually changed my diet and followed a vegan diet for about a month without telling anyone, because I knew that I was going to get a bit of flack for it. So yeah, I did that for about a month, and at the end of that month, I just sort of, the concept of eating those foods again just didn't seem right to me. And sort of when, I guess, being sort of 14 and making that decision, I was sort of very strongly encouraged by my family to make sure that I was doing all of the research to make sure that I was following a healthy diet and that I wasn't missing any important nutrients. And so that's sort of where my interest sort of sparked in nutrition, because I wanted to make sure that I was doing it well. And so the more reading I did, the more I realized that that was in fact sort of the best diet, not just for my own health, but also for the health of the planet. So that's sort of been a big part of my journey into veganism.
And you made that course so young. I mean, at 14, 15, I thought you'd be saying that your parents told you, you need to start eating meat for the nutrients, but instead they're telling you, do your research. So it's a very refreshing and unusual approach in terms of, okay, that's what you believe in, but prove it to us, you know, to make sure that it's feasible.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm absolutely eternally grateful, especially to my mum, who really encouraged that. There was no point at which I felt shut down for making that decision. It was just sort of like, well, that's the decision you're going to make. Do it well.
Yeah, absolutely. So this upbringing got you interested in nutrition. So you went to uni, you studied your dietetics, and you you were very involved in some really interesting research there. And I believe you did some traveling as well, all tied up with your degree. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I was incredibly lucky, actually. At the end of my undergraduate degree, I got a scholarship to do some research on epigenetics, which was actually my favourite topic of the undergraduate degree, and is still something I'm really interested in. And so through that research project, I was actually able to spend a summer sort of focused on looking at the sort of exact interaction between certain compounds and foods and how that influences how we express the genes on our DNA, which is kind of like that critical piece of information that really links, really proves the phrase, you are what you eat. Like, you can change your gene expression by simply what goes in your mouth.
Has that changed the way you eat?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, the term epigenetics, when mentioned, it seems to be quite a hot topic at the moment. But it also seems to be quite a big thing. And I don't want to start using the word it's a trend or anything, but there's a lot of, shall we say, you know, a lot of supplements and a lot of, you know, from a consumerism point of view, that points in that direction of epigenetics and then market a certain product. I mean, there's obviously a fine line between the true science and what people are now using as part of their marketing, isn't there?
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And I think in a nutshell, that was one of the reasons why I stepped away from it a little bit, is because I think at the moment we don't really have the evidence strong enough to actually support those day-to-day changes in a lot of ways. So I think the science is still so young, but it's got such an enormous amount of potential. But I guess, yeah, like you say, I do often see it oversold.
Now, speaking of selling food, doing a little digging through your LinkedIn profile, as I tend to do with a lot of people, is the one, I guess, a role that I saw was like, oh, this is a bit different. My food bag. Now, yes. I was really, I'll say, pleasantly surprised to see this role, your involvement with them, is particularly with what you do. So my food bag, to our listeners that are not aware, I mean, there's a lot of similar brands, but basically it's a subscription based, there are variances, but it's a subscription based setup whereby you get foods delivered, and they might include recipes, and it basically facilitates, it replaces your shopping, it replaces your need to think. It does make it easier for a lot of people, and I think there's a lot of merit with that. But Fiersha, your role with my food bag?
Yes, so I did a few different things for my food bag, but essentially I think probably the most interesting part of it was I was what they called the Fresh Start expert. So I was there to provide daily support and answer any questions on Facebook groups, through social media, for people that had signed up for my food bag and were following the Fresh Start program, which essentially was a special sort of bag that was designed to be lower calorie and help people to lose weight. So we ran a program that went alongside it that had sort of weekly emails giving advice to sort of help people reach their goals through that.
Yeah. So since then, you've gone on to found Feed Nutrition. Can you tell us a little bit about the services you offered there?
Yeah, so I went on to create Feed Nutrition as a bit of an outlet sort of once I graduated from university. I really wanted to have a space where I could sort of have full autonomy to sort of help people live healthier and happier lives. So that's sort of always been my mission behind Feed Nutrition. And I wanted to create something that I could sort of, like, I guess an umbrella that I could put all of my passion projects under as well. So the main part of Feed Nutrition is, yeah, I offer one-on-one consults via Zoom to help coach three people through sort of finding ways to eat a healthy and balanced diet and sort of help them find their own formula and what works for them and their lifestyle. But I also do a few speaking events and post a few recipes and that sort of thing as well.
Now, you work at the North Shore Hospital as a renal dietitian. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that role entails?
Yeah, sure. So I'm quite lucky working at Waitemata. I guess being a smaller DHB, although I guess in the context of New Zealand, still quite a large DHB, I'm able to wear a few different hats. So as part of my role as a renal dietitian there, I see people with chronic kidney disease. So that's usually people with stage 4 or 5 kidney disease, and help to sort of give them suggestions on ways that we can modify their diet to help reduce progression of disease, but also help manage any other symptoms that are coming up or any sort of other issues like high blood pressure or high electrolyte levels. Then I also cover dialysis. So I have a bunch of patients that are under my care and they receive hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. So that's effectively cleaning the blood or using the tummy to clean the blood of those toxins that our kidneys would usually clear. I help give advice to them. And I also cover the renal ward. So that can be anything from acute kidney injuries to people on dialysis who are acutely unwell.
Yeah. Now, chronic kidney disease, it is one of the leading causes of premature death in developed countries like ours. And unfortunately, the rates are increasing. I was reading a paper just last week, actually, a really scary statistic out of America that up to 96% of those with mild to moderate disease actually go undiagnosed. So this is a really important kind of issue to be addressed. What are the stats like in New Zealand for kidney disease?
Yeah, so we have a bit of data on kidney disease in New Zealand. The most recently published information was sort of completed in 2019. So we have good data on people on dialysis and people who get transplants, but not so good data on chronic kidney disease. So we have about 600 people starting on dialysis every year in New Zealand. And that's people who have reached end-stage kidney failure, so their kidneys are no longer working, and they're dependent on a machine to do the jobs of their kidneys. And overall, we have about 2,800 people on dialysis. But the stats are quite similar in Australasia compared to what you're talking about in America. So we know that sort of globally, one in 10 people actually have chronic kidney disease. Which is absolutely huge, and I think it's something that goes really unnoticed.
Yeah. So what are some of the contributors? I know that type 2 diabetes is a really big one, so between 20 to 40% of people with type 2 diabetes will actually go on to develop chronic kidney disease, unfortunately, but are there kind of big ticket items that people should be aware of?
So diabetes is one of the major ones, and high blood pressure. Those are the two main causes of chronic kidney disease, and things like smoking, age, and family history also affect your risk of having chronic kidney disease. But I think the main thing to be aware of is that we have so much power to actually prevent people reaching end-stage kidney failure if you pick it up early. And like you say, with only potentially 4 to 10% of people actually knowing that they have chronic kidney disease, it's really, really important to make sure that you're getting tested if you have any of those risk factors. In Australia, they recommend that you get a kidney health checkup every 1 to 2 years if you have any of those risk factors, like diabetes, like cardiovascular disease, like being over 60, smoking, those sorts of things.
Yeah, and when you say checkup, are you just meaning as easy as going and getting the blood test to check your GFR, or are there other certain tests that people should be looking at once they reach a certain age?
Yeah, so the GFR test is a really good indication of your kidney function. They might also want to do a urine test, depending on what sort of risk factors you've got as well. But if you can pick kidney disease up early, you can actually halve the progression rate. So you can effectively double your time before reaching end stage, and potentially even not get there if you pick it up in at the right time.
So a key factor is picking up the issues early before it becomes so severe in terms of stage 4, stage 5. What are some of the symptoms one might exhibit?
So that's part of the issue, is there's generally not too many symptoms until you reach stage 4 or 5. So your kidney's pretty wonderful at compensating. And so it's generally not until you reach sort of 15 to 30% kidney function that you might get symptoms. So that's why that regular screening is super, super important. But I guess if you are sort of reaching that stage, some things that you might want to look out for are things like fluid retention. So you might get puffiness around the ankles if you're spending a lot of your day sitting. If you're waking up short of breath, that can mean that you've got a little bit of fluid retention in your chest as well. So things like that can be signs of kidney disease. But you definitely want to aim to pick anything like that up before you're symptomatic.
Yeah, and I mean, the kidneys are a very vascular organ as well, so there's a bit of overlap here with recommendations to cardiovascular disease. But in terms of nutrition, what should we all be doing to optimise our kidney health? What should we be eating? What should we be avoiding?
Yeah, I guess, like you say, it is pretty similar to the general dietary recommendations for good health. So if you're wanting to protect your kidneys, make sure that you stay really well hydrated. Don't let yourself get too dehydrated. Our kidneys like to have plenty of fluid and water going in. And making sure that you're eating plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables. That's really, really important too. If you know that you have diabetes or high blood pressure, making sure that you're taking the right actions to manage that as well. So managing your blood sugars or helping to keep your blood pressure down. So that might be through sort of looking at how much salt you have in the diet as well. We know that most of us eat too much salt, so bringing that down can be really helpful.
So on the topic of nutrition, you mentioned salt. Are there any other particular foods that would contribute to, to the issue?
Yeah. So I think any sorts of processed foods are definitely less than ideal, especially processed meats and foods that are high in saturated fats. Sugar sweetened drinks as well are another big contributor. So those would be the main foods that I'd be saying to avoid if you want to encourage kidney health.
Yeah. So I know once upon a time there was a recommendation for CKD patients to adhere to the lower protein diet to reduce the uric acid buildup and the potential for nephrotoxicity. But something we need to be careful about in this population, obviously, is cachexia, so a wasting syndrome. Mm-hmm. And really interesting, something that I've been reading more and more of in the more recent kind of scientific papers on diet and kidney, is rather than recommending a decrease in protein per se, there's actually a push to just recommend a change of protein source, so a change to plant proteins rather than the animal proteins. I'm wondering if you could unpack for the listeners a little bit just the key differences in protein from plants as opposed to protein from animals in terms of kidney health.
Yeah, sure. So I guess to start off with, you've got quite a different protein density from animal-based proteins and plant-based proteins. So, so for example, a portion of meat is going to have more grams of protein than sort of a comparative plant protein source, because our plant proteins, they're also packaged with more fiber and other nutrients. So simply by doing a swap, you're probably going to reduce total protein intake. So just to begin with, that can be a big help for people who are really struggling with reducing their protein intake. With your plant-based proteins as well, we also have a lot more positive nutrients in there. We've got more fiber. Constipation is a big issue for a lot of our people on dialysis and with chronic kidney disease. That's really helpful. And you get less toxins produced from plant-based proteins. So from animal proteins, you get more uremic toxins, which is not so good for our gut health. And it also creates more toxins, which are damaging to, like you say, those tiny little nephrons in the kidneys. Whereas our plant-based proteins with the fiber, they also encourage growth of more beneficial bacteria in the gut, which helps to reduce the burden of toxins in the blood that are going to be damaging to your kidney. So absolutely, yeah, there's a lot of emerging research showing that that plant proteins are much better for the kidney than animal proteins.
Now, when you talk about total protein intake, is there a concern consuming protein powders, protein shakes, because of that total, even if it's a plant-based protein, which tends to be isolated, so it doesn't have the fiber, as you mentioned, is a good thing. Mm. Is that an issue? Too much protein in general, even?
I think it would depend on the case, really, and depends on sort of what your training requirements are as well. I think, our protein requirements vary quite a lot person to person. So, yeah, I think protein powders can be a good way to sort of help you reach your goals if you need it in a convenient way. But yeah, I think if you're having a lot of shakes in a day, then rather than having your protein from whole food sources, that could be an issue.
Yeah. Now, when the kidneys are compromised during renal failure, you've already mentioned this, they can't excrete certain nutrients properly, so the phosphate and the potassium. And that can end up with the development of high levels in the blood, which can be a bit problematic. So again, once upon a time, older research was basically suggesting that we should tell kidney patients to lower their phosphate and their potassium intake across the board, whether it comes from animal or plant sources. But the narrative, is that changing a little bit in this space?
I think amongst dietitians, it's changed hugely. Like you say, there's more and more evidence sort of coming out that points in a different direction. I think traditionally there has been that approach, although certainly throughout my career, it's only ever been restriction based on blood levels. So we take monthly bloods for all of our dialysis patients, so we don't restrict anything that's within an acceptable range. But yes, there's a lot of change in perception of that. And actually, our Auckland regional renal dietitians are currently reworking all of our resources for patients to actually reflect that. I think the way that we talk about potassium phosphate has changed hugely as dietitians, but I think the information that we find online is still the same information. So that causes a big disconnect for our patients and can be really confusing. But essentially, yeah, maybe it's easier if I maybe discuss phosphate and then potassium, because they're quite different. So maybe if I start with phosphate. So phosphate from plant foods is quite tightly, it's complex with a lot of other things, so we don't absorb it that well. So high phosphate plant foods are less likely to push our blood levels up than high phosphate animal or dairy foods. And we also know that the phosphate that comes from processed foods is generally the biggest issue, because it's the additives that we absorb, that we absorb almost sort of 90% of. And when they're additives, they can be put in quite high doses and have quite a big impact on our blood levels. So it's like when we talk about phosphate, we're generally targeting processed foods, processed meats, looking at animal protein intake, maybe then dairy. And then if we still haven't managed to resolve it, we might look at nuts and seeds. Yeah, I think we generally tend to focus away from sort of plant-based phosphate. And then I guess potassium is a little bit different. So potassium can, traditionally has been very focused around fruits and vegetables. And that's also come from a place where we've actually in the past overestimated protein requirements for people on dialysis. So when we've people have created guidelines for potassium, they've sort of written in the fact that dialysis patients need to be eating this amount of meat, and that's something that has changed a lot in our practice. So we're moving the focus away from fruits and vegetables with potassium a little, because the fruits and vegetables that are higher in potassium are also good for our health in other ways. And potassium from fruits and vegetables as well, it's also more alkalizing, so how that impacts on our blood levels is a little bit unclear. So there's definitely still a lot of work that needs to be done in potassium, but there are lots of ways around that too. So you can still choose lower potassium fruits and vegetables, and you can also effectively remove potassium by sort of like washing your foods as well. So like using wet cooking methods like boiling and poaching can actually pull a lot of potassium out because it's very water soluble.
So is there perhaps a, you know, let's be optimistic here, but amongst the renal dietitian community, is there perhaps a bit of a movement towards understanding the bigger benefits of plant-sourced foods, fruit, vegetables, etc., and like you say, nuts and seeds can be a little bit touch and go depending the level of extremity, versus the more so detrimental effects of, well, you still got to consume your meat, your eggs, your fish, even if it's organic, even if it's this, that, whatever, because of the bigger picture. You know, some concerns with fruit and veg, but it's overarching benefits of fiber and all the other minerals and vitamins and so on. So is there perhaps a bit of a shift happening globally?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I think that's sort of been reflected in our new Kidoki guidelines as well. While they didn't really talk too much about sort of different types of protein through their recommendations on total protein intake, that's, like I said earlier, with your very low protein diets, it's almost only achievable through a vegan diet. But certainly within my circles as well, there's a lot of discussion around plant-based diets and what potential that has for our patients as well. So it's very much a hot topic amongst renal dietitians. And yeah, really it's what's driven our working group to actually look at redesigning a lot of our resources that we give to patients.
That's so encouraging. That's fantastic to hear. It really is. What about the uptake with patients? Are they keen to be adding in more beans and less beef?
Honestly, it is such a spectrum. Yeah. And it's often the least people you'd expect that are the most enthusiastic advocates. So I think when it comes to like the chronic kidney disease, like before dialysis, a lot of people are really happy to start by having a couple of vegetarian meals per week. Some will be open to going sort of completely vegetarian, and others will not even be open to having slightly less than sort of 3 to 4 serves of meat in a day. It's a huge, huge variety.
Now, one thing I just want to sidetrack a little bit, and it's going to come from my end, and I hope I don't put you on the spot too much, but you've touched on a few things here. One is the importance of hydration. You know, sufficient hydration is good for kidney health. Now, coming from my background, endurance sports, and I don't necessarily mean super ultra events, even as much as marathons. Now, marathons are a lot for a lot of people, but anything that's excessive, you know, there's quite a few papers out there with the link of, I guess, excessive heat, which is then linked to, you know, poor hydration or insufficient fluid intake. So acute kidney injuries within the endurance community, so a lot of endurance sports. Have you come across any of that or have any thoughts on that topic specifically?
In terms of coming across it, I would have to say that in 2 years practicing as a renal dietitian, it's not something that has come under my nose. I haven't been made aware of a single case, but having said that, we don't necessarily always see all of the acute kidney injuries. They don't necessarily come under a renal service. But I think in terms of those endurance events, like you say, making sure that you're adequately hydrated is really the key. Every person is going to be a little bit different. So I'd say if you are wanting to compete in an event like a marathon, it's probably worth at least having a session with a sports dietitian and actually working out what your fluid requirements are for the event and what to do in the training leading up to it. And I think that's the best way to make sure that you're protecting your health through those endurance events.
Yeah. And a common thing that does pop up, and it's more of a note to our listeners, and it's quite a scary trend, is the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, so ibuprofens and the like, and that there's also quite a link towards, you know, the consumption of those and risk factors for acute kidney injury. So hence why it's a strong push, do not consume them during, because that can also accelerate dehydration as well and put bigger strain on the kidneys.
Yeah, I'd say that's good advice if you can. Yeah.
So in a nutshell, in a low phosphate nutshell, what would be your key tips to, as far as nutrition goes, to ensure that we have really good kidney health, long life?
Yeah. So key tips for kidney health: make sure that you stay really well hydrated. Make sure that you're careful about how much salt is sneaking into your diet. So if you can avoid processed foods, that's really good for bringing your salt intake down. Making sure that you're focusing your diet around having plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, plenty of whole grains, and a good variety across the food groups.
Perfect.
Amazing. Fuchsia, this has been brilliant. It's so nice to have conversations that are very specific. For some people, it might not that interesting, but I think it is important sometimes to deep dive into certain very specific topics. So thank you.
But it should be important for everyone, though, considering those stats about how many people don't know they have this issue.
100%.
So, yeah.
100%.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to actually note that in Australia, there's actually 2 times more people with chronic kidney disease than there are with diabetes. And you think how much we hear about diabetes. And
you only hear about it once it's actually a problem.
That's very true. Yeah.
So, okay, I take back some of what I've said. Hugely important, but it is. And I think it was good for me to also raise a very specific group, athletes. You know, as athletes, we think, oh, we're healthy. You know, everything's healthy. Everything's functioning well because I'm active, because, well, we can still put ourselves in a different form of risk as well. So a very important topic. For those of you in Auckland who would like to see and hear Fuchsia present and speak, part of the evidence-based eating series of talks that they're putting on later this year. The Auckland date is Saturday, the 4th of September. It is a long time away, but bookmark it in your diary. We will put a note on there.
It'll
a link
worth the wait
to that in our show notes. And Fuchsia is part of a panel with Professor Boyd Swinburne, who's been a past guest of ours, as well as Dr. Mark Craig. So it's going to be certainly a very fascinating evening. Fuchsia, thank you so much. We really appreciate your insight into a very important topic. And thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.